Hey guys, it's Anthony Bandiero here, senior legal instructor for Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training, bringing you another podcast. I am joined by a very well-known person, Kenny Williams. I know him as the Red Ninja. He's been doing this interdiction game for a very, very long time, but let him introduce himself. We're going to spend some time with you, get to know him, also talk about some current legal trends and some issues that we see out there and so forth. How you doing, my friend?
Awesome. Absolute pleasure to be on the podcast with you. So thank you very much for that, this opportunity.
All right. No, thank you. All right. So you've been in this interdiction game for a long time. How'd you get started doing this?
So a little bit about my backstory. I never really anticipated being a cop. Going through high school, I was kind of mediocre. Went to college. My first year in college, 9/11 happens. I was kind of going to school to be maybe a teacher. I wanted to kind of help mold the youth. I come from a background where I had some family members that were addicted to drugs, and I saw that. And I was hoping that if I could, have some impact, maybe even on one student that kind of had similar background, that I could show them a path that to stay away from it, to avoid it. So I thought maybe education was a good route. And then September 11th happened. And it kind of completely changed my perspective. At the time, I was paying for my own college. And after 9/11, I went to my grandparents and I said, hey, I'm going to go join the military. And they said, well, why do you want to do that? I explained basically like I couldn't afford college. And my main reason is I just wanted to, after 9/11, I just wanted to do something that was impactful to kind of help the country out. So they're like, well, we'll pay for college. I'm like, all right, well, kind of. I had a complete counter argument. I didn't really have anything else now that they're going to pay
for college. Right, you had a backup plan on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was like, all right, well, then I'm going to change my major. I want to be a cop. So I go through, get my degree in criminal justice, and finally got hired at my current agency, the first agency that hired me in 2007. I didn't know what interdiction was, but my goal, again, there was like, all right, if I can just maybe stop people from using drugs, like finding a gram, like anything along those lines, like that's kind of my motivation behind it all. And then in the police academy, at 16 or 18 weeks long, there was a 3-hour block with criminal interdiction, and I was completely hooked to it. I was like, well, man, if I can find a kilo, maybe I will have some type of positive impact on someone.
Yeah.
Go back to my agency, first 5 years, there's no interdiction team, just working general patrol, being proactive, just trying to find, more of local stuff that you would find in communities, not necessarily looking for kilos. I didn't even think it could translate. Looking back, it probably could have. But so I was just trying to be proactive in between calls for service and all those types of things. And then I found out about this like part-time interdiction team, and I finally bugged enough right people to get on that in 2012. Had some luck on the highway, and then 2016, my agency created a full-time spot for me to go up on the highway.
Wow. So a lot of people, I teach a lot of obviously cops, and, I like to say there's some sexy assignments in law enforcement, SWAT, right? People want to be SWAT. But if you don't have that, that temperament, whatever, then it's like the interdiction guys, right? I mean, people love interdiction. They make movies about this stuff. But at the same time, like you have a lot of cops that are just never going to be full-time interdictors, right? They don't have the team. The agency doesn't have the kind of resources. But I would presume that you teach every cop, like no matter what, every cop can work interdiction when they have some downtime, right?
Yeah, that's what I talk about in my class. I talk about, if you're traveling across the country or if you're traveling for 20 minutes, if you get stopped by the cop and you're involved in criminal activity, the last thing you could do is tell the cop the truth. So it's on us just to have that conversation, and kind of determine if they're being deceptive or not.
Okay. So what kind of case law issues do you see out there involving this space?
I think a lot of people misunderstand like the reasonable suspicion and actually how long they have when it comes to the detention aspect once you have met the reasonable suspicion. Because I get a lot of messages or a lot of conversations from class about, well, we don't have any dogs, and the closest dog is 30 minutes away. And I was like, I always try to explain it and go into great detail. Like once you have reasonable suspicion, there's multiple case laws that support you have an exorbitant amount of time to get a dog there, as long as you're doing your due diligence to get the dog there. And it's on you as the officer that stopped the vehicle to be able to explain that reasonable suspicion in court. And once you meet the reasonable suspicion threshold, I mean, you have, I mean, I don't know. I was, I
you
know, there's
you,
like,
don't, you know, you don't have forever, but you have, I guess you have enough time, right?
Yeah.
And you actually said the magic word, in my world, the magic word is diligent, right? The diligence, right? It's just, if you are being diligent, you're being reasonable. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And what is diligent in, you know, and how much time in the middle of Dallas is going to be a lot different than nowhere in Nebraska. Now, I'll also tell you, I think that, you know, when I look at these cases, sometimes I'll read like the court will outline the reasonable suspicion. And to me, it's almost as good as probable cause. But I guess what I'm trying to say, though, if we're going to detain somebody for 55 minutes, you have to have some really solid reasonable suspicion. I know that reasonable suspicion is either there or it's not, but you would kind of agree with that. Like, you know, you are, I mean, if you're going to an hour or so, you are pushing in the sense that you better have a good case. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I know like there's one out of Pennsylvania. I think it's the longest one that I've seen in one of the federal superior courts or whatever. And it was an hour and 24 minutes. And it was from like 23 or 24. And that one I show because theoretically in that area, they're usually on the more liberal side where they're, you know, not necessarily super pro law enforcement. And the officer did a great job of explaining it. And I think they listed like six different major factors for that reasonable suspicion that allowed him to, I think the stop was like 15, 18 minutes long. And then it was like an hour and 24 minutes to get the dog there. I'm like, that's almost 2 hours you're approaching from stop and, you know, detention to get a dog there. And the court ruled it in the cop's favor in that one.
Yeah, actually, that opens the door for a plug. So I teach report writing. And one of the things that I teach is the strive for five. It's arbitrary, but it's like, you know, a lot of times when cops, you know, can articulate five or more reasons about why they're doing what they're doing, you know, it's hard for courts to suppress something when the cop is really being articulate. And, you know, what I have found, and I think that you probably can agree with that, I mean, people you've taught, is that a lot of times the officers are right. You know, they do have reasonable suspicion, or they do have probable cause, or they do have, you know, a justification for what they're doing, but they skimp out on the report, or they skimp out their articulation. Do you find that's true?
Yeah,
just the lack of articulation.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of cops, it's like they know it's there, it's in their brain, but then when it comes to like going and writing the report, for whatever reason, it just doesn't transition well. Like we know that, I don't think that they're doing out there doing anything malicious. It's just like it's here and they're seeing it and they know it, and then all of a sudden it's like, all right, you just found 5 kilos in your adrenaline dump, and now you got to go type a report. And I think you kind of just like, I don't know, your brain's overloaded with adrenaline and you're like trying to figure out and type a report and document everything that you saw at the time and everything that you heard and why it was important. And I feel like sometimes in that avenue is kind of where cops miss the boat, myself included, especially being young. Like you get really excited, you kind of get ahead of yourself, and then you go back to write the report. For my first 2 years, I didn't have cameras or anything. So now, like, you know, I'm trying to come off memory of everything that took place, and I don't want to lie on there. So that adrenaline dump kind of erased some of it, I feel like, it wasn't coming to me at the time. And then all of a sudden later on, after my reports and my affidavits are submitted, I'm like, oh, I remember this. I didn't put that in there, or this or that. And I kind of think that's where a lot of younger cops miss the boat. It's not intentional. It's just like the excitement of the situation has then still there when you go and type the report, and you're so much adrenaline and dopamine going through your body that you're not thinking clearly.
How do you fix that then, right? So is the solution to have some time or to watch the video again and then write the report?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I mean, for me, I think it's huge that you are able to watch the report or watch the video as you type your report. Not that you're going to miss anything or anything like that, but now you get to watch parts of it and that, oh yeah, this is what I saw. And if you can narrate on the video aspect of it while things are taking place, I think it goes a long way in court too. I'm not the best at it. I've seen people that are amazing. Like as you know, real life is happening, they're able to say like, you know, this is important or whatever. And it's just a cue for them. And it's also cueing the courts and that like, oh yeah, this was important. That's why I said that. And then when I go to type it, it's readily available.
Yeah, I'll tell you that I do like when cops narrate. The counter argument, though, is that if they do not narrate something that they actually did observe, then, well, if you're narrating, why don't you observe, right? Why don't you say X, Y, Z? So it can kind of work against you, but I will tell you that more often than not, I will at least say that the big things, right? Like, for example, smelling marijuana. And the officer does not want to tip off the guy that he smells marijuana. So let's say that he He just asked for consent. You know, he thinks that he might get consent if he doesn't tip the guy off that he smells marijuana in a state that's illegal, right? So, and then the guy says no, and he says, well, look, I can smell marijuana coming from your vehicle. I'm not going to search it. I have seen courts, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and so forth kind of be like, well, if you really smelled it, why didn't you say anything about it? And the cop would say, because I don't, if I smell and I tell him, and I'm also, can I search your car? And he knows he has it in there. He's not going to, maybe he'll just hope that I don't find it if I don't smell it. Right. So when the cops will say something like in the car while they're doing their, their check and their warrant check, hey, I smell marijuana. It's a strong odor of marijuana, fresh marijuana, whatever. Then they go and ask for consent and then they get denied. I feel that the courts find that to be more credible. Just that whole narrating thing.
I've seen some officers too, like give a thumbs up. So like as they approach the car, if they smell it, they just turn around, look at their camera.
Oh, up, right.
And it's no one really knows what that means besides that cop. Right. And he can go testify like at this point, when I give the thumbs up, I do this every time. And I smell marijuana at this point.
Yeah. Is marijuana illegal where you're at for recreational use?
Yeah. We have no medical. We have no recreational.
Yeah. So it's still pretty much game on when it comes to searching cars. Have you found like the courts will have a difference between raw marijuana and burnt marijuana? In other words, where you can search. I've seen a case, you might be familiar with that. It was out of California, I believe, but the cop testified that he smelled burnt marijuana. And, you know, the guy was like basically smoking and driving, and he searched the trunk and the court threw it out. Have you ever heard those arguments?
I have. In Indiana, there was one that it wasn't published recently or something like that. I don't know the whole, but that was the initial argument, is that there was something in the trunk, smelled burnt marijuana. But I'm pretty sure Indiana is still consistent. If you smell it, you have the entire vehicle.
Right. Just whether it's burnt or fresh marijuana.
Correct.
Yeah. What other issues are you seeing out there? So we have reasonable suspicion, which one thing is, it is a low standard. I mean, it's, you know, as the Supreme Court said, it's a moderate chance of criminal activity. But it's I like to say it's factors of here and now. It's not a very, it's not a lot. It's just, why do you believe that, you know, criminal activity is afoot? So then you're diligent and so forth. What else do you see out there?
I have a question though. You said the rule of five. So you're looking for five independent factors that are, involving criminal activity that they can articulate during the stop that are independent, basically?
Yeah, so that's right. So that's what I teach. So look, and the reason why is because ultimately, reasonable suspicion and probable cause are based on totality of circumstances. So when you have a lot of, I mean, reasonable suspicion by definition is nothing is illegal yet. You're just acting suspicious. It's not illegal to look in a jewelry store window five times in 10 minutes, go back and forth, but it's kind of odd, right? But each individual factor is not illegal. If it was, we just call that probable cause. So because we use TOC, totality of circumstances, the next thing is the more factors that can paint that picture, the better. What I have found consistently is that I'll get an officer, for example, they'll do a pat down. And in the report, it says something like, I did a pat down because the stop was made in a high crime area and the person has a criminal history. You know, let's say, for example, they were released from prison, you know, 6 months ago for an armed robbery. And then they'll say, okay, for those two reasons, I conducted a pat down. Now, my viewpoint on that is that that's not reasonable suspicion of armed and dangerous. The problem is the cop, in a very literal sense, is going to court and saying, Your Honor, once a criminal, always a criminal. If they're dangerous in the past, they're dangerous in the future. And I like to say, they're essentially telling the court, Your Honor, in my world, they can't find Jesus. They can't be a good person in my world. And we know, you know, and I'm not saying this is, you know, but a lot of, you know, whether it's liberal courts or conservative courts, we know that a lot of people, about 30% maybe, do leave prison or jail, whatever, and become, you know, a good person. They don't commit crimes anymore. They have found religion. They have found family support. They got off the drugs and so forth. But the main thing is, when I call those cops, because, you know, the report gets denied, the gun gets tossed, or the drugs get tossed, and the DA is like, hey, can you just go talk to this guy? Because I can't take a report where there's no here and now. Like, where is the here and now factors? And when I talked to the officer and I said, hey, what else did you, because the case is denied, you know, you're probably not going to be able to say it. We could save it if we really wanted to, but, you know, a lot of big cities are not taking the time to save all these cases with a supplemental. So I say, look, my job is to train you. What else did you know? And almost every single time, The cop has more factors. They'll talk about a delayed stop. They'll talk about, hey, I did actually see him bending over to the right, you know, like furtive movements. They'll talk about that he had gang attire. Whatever it is, there's almost always other factors that when you get the officer, whether watching a video or just talking to them, that they will articulate more factors. And then, that's why I have this rule of five, because I'm just trying to push cops to articulate more, not less, because the name of the game to me is articulation. You know, I like to say Shakespeare, you know, said, ye who articulates the most wins. He did not say that, by the way, Kenny. I'm just totally making that stuff up. But the point is, because, I mean, he could have said it. We wouldn't know. I mean, I'm not really a big reader of Shakespeare. But the point is that, you know, ye who articulates the most wins. And that's why I have that arbitrary thing. Now, at the same time, you know, I don't want to, you know, give the impression that cops need five or more things. I mean, if you see a guy running out a 7-Eleven with a gun in his hand, even if you don't have the burglary call or the armed robbery call yet, we don't have the silent alarm. We know that that guy's getting stopped, and we have articulation for, you know, whatever we're gonna do. But that's why I teach that.
I like it. Yeah, I always talk, for whatever reason, I've always, like, the magic number was six for me. So I was curious about the five. I always try to, like, at least have six independent factors. That was my, like, and I don't cover case law, but I do, like. And during the stop, like, just try to, you know, it is a very small threshold, reasonable suspicion. So just try to get six independent factors that you can articulate that you've seen previously, you've been taught about criminal activity, and it's met that something's more. So I was just curious about the five. That's interesting.
Well, I'll tell you that yours is clearly wrong, not to be, you know, aggressive here, because it does not rhyme.
Right.
So it does not flow off the tongue like strive for five. But I will tell you, I was teaching a class in LA, and I had a federal prosecutor in my class, and she came up to me. She was very nice. And she says, hey, this whole strive for five thing, you know, is that based on a case? Like, did you actually find case? Am I missing something? And I said, no, it's just, you know, intuition, just like your six is intuition. And by the way, more is better, right? So now your class is better than mine because you have six and I have five. So she said, well, the reason I'm asking is because I was in federal court one time with an agent, and they were on the stand testifying for whatever. And the judge asked the agent, hey, give me five reasons about why you did what you did. And the agent did what he did, but she was like, I was too nervous and I didn't want to, like, ask, like, Your Honor, why are you asking for five things? And she just thought, like, maybe there is a case out there that talked about these five things, and that's where he's kind of getting it from. And there's no case out there. And then I was teaching in Vegas. And there's another prosecutor who actually now teaches for me part-time. And she was teaching a class called it After the Arrest. And by the way, very clever name, concept. She was teaching, hey, what happens after you drop them off at jail? Kind of a clever, right, Kenny? Kind of clever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
It's just kind of interesting stuff, like the Sixth Amendment and, you know, just things about your judges. You know, judges have, they do legislate from the bench, right? They have, you know, some judges are just awful. And it's like, you can't control, like, if we dismiss cases, it's maybe because we know that this judge won't do anything. So it's just kind of interesting. But she was like, part of it is also the strive for five. So that's where it came from in my universe. But that's great. I'm glad to actually hear that you're doing that, because it kind of affirms that, you know, I'm onto something here, because I think it's important for these cops to articulate as much as possible.
I agree. One question I have. So you talked about criminal history, and so from my understanding, running criminal histories during the course of a traffic stop would have to be consistent across the board. You have to do it on every traffic stop, but I could be wrong. So that's kind of where I was, because I know the one case I was talking about in Pennsylvania, they ran this criminal history and either, like, he was lied about, or I forget exactly, but in my agency, we do not do that. So if we don't do it consistently, would we have to have the reasonable suspicion to theoretically extend the stop to get the criminal history?
The answer is no, not in my world. I do think that there is value in just looking good, right? There's, you know, cases do have PR to them. They do have you open the door. If you don't do it consistently, you do open the door, right? To this argument, you're unlawfully extending a traffic stop for an unrelated purpose. But at the end of the day, there's no case that I've found that ever says that. I mean, you know, and not a case that is binding authority, you know, or appellate level. you can always find any set of facts at the district court level, right? You can always find a wacky judge that says, well, if you're not doing it every time, you're unlawfully extending this up. But at the end of the day, we know at the appellate level that courts have upheld running criminal history because it's part of officer safety, right? And that, now I will tell you that I do have a difference with passengers, and we should talk about that. But when it comes to the driver or whoever the focus of the stop is, it can be the passenger in some cases, but whoever the focus of the stop is, cops do have the authority to triple I and run criminal history, whatever, as a matter of routine, and even if they don't do it routinely. Because okay, the question for the court, let's say we go up to the Supreme Court, is, hey, was that running the criminal history, was that in and of itself an unlawful extension of stop? Do you need reasonable suspicion for that? And the answer is no. One last thing, though, that I'll tell you that I've run into is that a lot of these criminal databases, right, whether it's NCIC, you know, and so forth, they do have a terms of service, a TOS, that does say that in state databases are like this too, right? Georgia, whatever they call it, GIS, you know, whatever the Georgia system is, they say that you cannot run criminal history without, you know, a legitimate, basically reasonable suspicion, but like some kind of legitimate investigatory purpose. And the reason why they do that, in my view, is for two reasons. Number one, primarily, they do not want to overload the system with just random, you know, let's say an agency has a facial recognition software. And they are able to, you know, with public records and so forth, they're able to face ID people going down the street on Main Street. And as a matter of course, they're also running those people through criminal history. Now, that has a lot of other implications, right, of privacy and so forth. But I'm just saying they would probably get hammered if for no other reason, just the fact that they're going to overload the database with thousands of inquiries every single day. The other thing the agencies do this, or the database providers do this, is because they don't want you running your babysitter, right? So they want to kind of prevent the officer from abusing the system, which is, again, part of the terms of service. But to answer your question at the end, I have never seen a case that says when it comes to criminal history that you have to do it on everybody.
Okay.
I have not seen it. Have you seen it?
No, not at all. That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
But it was a question that came up about, you know, doing it routinely. And I know for a fact the Pennsylvania State Police does it on all their traffic stops.
They do. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah.
So like, yep, that's why I was like, well, maybe that's why I was accepted. Cause I was, you know, like I was always told there's no proof, mm-hmm, but like, you know, we couldn't even run criminal history on traffic stops unless we had something else. And we've come full circle on that. And over maybe the past 5 or 6 years, we have learned that our central dispatch was not being truthful on that because they just didn't want to do it. You know, so
they didn't want to do it because it's extra work.
Exactly. So like, yeah. So they were saying, oh, you can, unless it's an arrest. And I was like, I don't think that's right. So we, you know, I started to look into it, and they're like, I was like, no, that's completely wrong. And we were able to go through it, and we get them now, even during the course of the traffic stop. But typically if I'm running it, I already have some reasonable suspicion on why I want it. I just don't do it, yeah, as a matter of fact during every stop.
Sure. Or I like to call them breadcrumbs, like some things like that are just suspicious, but not necessarily reasonable suspicion. Right. You know, like, for example, I mean, a guy that's renting a car for a long period of time, but also says he's unemployed. I mean, it's nice to be him. Right. I mean, I know what rental cars cost. So do you. Yeah. They're expensive. But I will also, just so we're clear for the people who are watching this, because they're going to be like, well, Anthony says that a lot of these terms of service, you know, you have to have a legitimate, you know, an investigatory purpose. Is the traffic stop enough? And the answer is yes, right? You know, they just don't want people running their babysitter or running just random people. You know, one last example I'll give is registries, like hotel registries. Mm-hmm. So a lot of officers around the country will, you know, they have a good relationship with the Motel 6, the Red Roof Inn, and they want to, you know, get those registry information so they can start running people. That does not violate the Fourth Amendment, as long as they're not compelling these people to, hey, you have to hand over your information, right? We there's a Supreme Court case on that. You can't compel them, but you can certainly ask them for their third party records, right? Their records. And these agencies are sometimes also at the same time running them for warrants. Well, that doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment. It may, in certain circumstances, violate terms of service. But anyway, that's just an example, gotcha, I think. Yeah.
Let's talk about, this is always a hot topic, so the LPR case law stuff, and it's still ever evolving.
I love LPRs. LPRs are, I mean, just, I mean, if, especially in your world, right? I mean, they're super effective as far as just, you know, and like, I'm not in that space enough to know how you guys use them. And, you know, does it have some AI built into it? I'm sure it's going that direction regardless, but they'll kind of tell you like, hey, yeah, this car, you know, is showing patterns of some kind of suspicious patterns of travel plans and so forth. But right now, I think the main case that we have on this is a case out of Massachusetts. It was Commonwealth versus McCarthy. Oh, I can't believe I remember this case name. It's a case called Commonwealth versus McCarthy, and it might be the opposite, right? You know, sometimes you'll say Brown versus Texas, Texas versus Brown, but yep. whoever the appellant is there, what happened there is it's a great case, and it's a great case to kind of elucidate like what the courts are kind of looking for. So what happened there briefly is that the Massachusetts State Police, right? McCarthy is known to be a drug dealer, and he always goes to Cape Cod to buy his drugs. And he goes to this particular park, and he, you know, he does his, you know, transaction. Well, I guess there's only like one way to like one main way, I guess, to go get to Cape Cod, right? And they put his license plate in the reader so that when he was going to Cape Cod, it would say, hey, look, he just crossed the bridge. And they went out to that park. They probably used binoculars. They saw him doing the hand-to-hand transaction, whatever it was. And then they pre-text stopped him. They got into the car. I think they probably, you know, whatever they did, ran a dog, whatever. They got into the car lawfully, and they found a substantial amount of narcotics. Now, he goes to court and says, hey, that LPR violated my Fourth Amendment rights. Well, to first of all, you know, in order to have a Fourth Amendment claim, you would have to have a search, right? A search or a seizure. This is not a seizure because the LPR is not a seizure because it doesn't seize anything. So you have to be a search. Well, there are two searches under the Fourth Amendment. There's privacy and trespass. Trespass requires some kind of physical intrusion. LPR is never physically intrude. So you cannot argue that there's any kind of trespass. So what you're left with is privacy. And in order to have privacy, that's that going back to 1967, that's that Katz case, that's Charles Katz using the telephone in a telephone booth, and the FBI, you know, heard his conversation with the tape recorder. And the Supreme Court uses this test, a two-part test, which is first, did the suspect expect privacy? Did they even do you should subjectively be reasonable here. Should you like expect the stuff that you put on social media to be private? No. Should you expect that your first class mail is private? Clearly, right? So the U.S. Postal Service cannot just X-ray a priority mailbox package as a matter of routine. They can't do it, right? Because it's a U.S. government agency and it's a search. The next thing is it objectively reasonable. Well, if you go back to McCarthy, do you think he subjectively, it's reasonably subjectively expected that that crossing that bridge would be unknown to everybody? No. And even if he did, it would be objectively unreasonable. Now, that case, though, the reason I like that McCarthy case, because they did look at the future, right? And they're like, at some point, Kenny, like at some point, these LPRs may implicate the Fourth Amendment. And I'll tell you, in my world, this is when that occurs, I think. And guess I'm taking a stab at this, right? In my world, LPRs implicate the Fourth Amendment when they can replicate your travel patterns with detail. Right now, LPRs are not that. They're just as far as like if you put on a map, you know, whatever, the United States or my city or my whatever, you know, yeah. I mean, look, a lot of cities have LPRs, and you can really, you know, you can kind of like, oh, he hit at this intersection, and then he hit at this intersection, and so forth. But that replication, like just knowing where Anthony is so coarse. It's so rudimentary that it's just, there's no way that it's going to violate my expectation of privacy yet. However, I want you to imagine a city like Las Vegas, where I'm from. So Las Vegas, back up. So Las Vegas is a very high tech city because it's a newer city. You know, they don't have infrastructure issues. They, you know, they have a lot of just modern building, right? So that means that they just have like a lot of cool tech stuff. And one of the things that they have is almost at every single intersection. I mean, when I say almost everyone, I mean this, that has a light, they have a camera on it. And that's I mean, there's just tens and tens and tens of thousands of cameras, right? And they use those for traffic cues, right? For gridlock. So it's just basically, if you have a, they're looking at the car, the front of the cars, right? So if they see a long traffic queue, they'll open up longer. Okay, so it's pretty smart. Well, I want you to imagine that a company called Acme LPRs and software company goes to Las Vegas and they say, hey, if we install our software on your traffic management computers, not only will it give you the information you want, which is the management, the traffic queue, but it also will read their front license plate, because Nevada is a front license plate state. And we can actually turn that to LPR. And so with this information, we can actually track people going around the city in a very detailed way. I think that's a search.
Okay.
I think it potentially could be a search, because this is what they would call the mosaic theory. The mosaic theory is when you can basically replicate, or you can know a person's inner secrets, location, and so forth, without actually doing any hard work, any heavy lifting. And we get the mosaic theory from a case called Carpenter. Are you familiar with Carpenter? That's that cell. Okay. And I know your partner over there that teaches search and seizure, he definitely knows this case. Carpenter is a Supreme Court case where Carpenter and like four or five of his buddies were robbing cell phone stores. And it's going to be a coincidence there in a second, but they were robbing cell phone stores, and the FBI got a subpoena to get 121 days or so of his cell phone location information, right? The triangulation, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so they looked at this for 121 days and they found that 7 days of that they put him at the crime scenes. Well, so that was good information. So, and that's why it's kind of funny. Like they used his cell phone to find that he was robbing cell phone stores. So there's kind of like the connection there. But anyway, it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, first of all, we don't have a trespass. The U.S. government did not trespass on his physical phone. They didn't touch it. They didn't grab it. They didn't push the buttons. Now the next question is privacy. Does Carpenter have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his cell site location information? Well, the government's saying no, because when you have a cell phone, what are you doing there? You're giving the information. You know that the cell phone company is going to have your information, right?
Yeah.
And so you're basically, I mean, they're using it for marketing. They're using it for cell tower maintenance. They're using it for congestion. So I know that when I signed up for this contract with my company, that I know that they know where this phone is at. So that's called the third party data doctrine. I have handed over my data consensually or whatever to the company. And so that's what the government's arguing. But the Supreme Court says, look, it's bigger than that. Because if you could just get cell site location information without a warrant, which is no probable cause, just on a subpoena, then are you going to replicate a person's life? Would you know what church they go to or don't go to? Do you know who their friends are? Do you know what businesses they attend? Do you know what their job is? Do you know what their political affiliations are? Maybe, right? They're going to rallies and so forth, right? So yeah. The point is that the Supreme Court came up with this idea, and a lot of people call it the mosaic theory, because amazing, you know, the mosaic is like, it's those pictures, right, that have little mm-hmm. pieces of one color, but then you look at it from a 30,000 point view and you can see a picture of Mona Lisa.
Yep.
So they're saying that if you can just know where their location is, then you're able to know a lot about their intimate activities, and that is private, and that implicates the Fourth Amendment, which, going back to the LPR argument, at some point, I'll tell you one more thing. Not only with those traffic cameras, but you take an old city like Boston that doesn't have maybe, you know, as much, I mean, but you have the mesh networks, right, where private people are voluntarily giving the government, local police department, access to their Ring door cam, security cameras. And then you combine that with Burger King is also giving that information, right? So you feed all this information into a massive supercomputer, and that is able to like facial recognition, LPRs, and you're able to be like, yep, Anthony was at the XYZ political party last night at, you know, whatever, or he was at this house. That's in a long-winded way, that is what McCarthy was kind of talking about, is, hey, right now, no privacy. But one day we are going to have to address this, because it may turn into like a carpenter site situation.
That makes sense. Do you think it would go to the extent of there's ways that you can find cars that are traveling in long trips, say based on they scan by one LPR and then another one in a certain amount of time to see if they're traveling prior to stopping them, a long distance across country? Do you think one day that would be, or would you think it'd be more invasive where they're looking at multiple days at a time to see, like, okay, every day he does this routine?
I think that, yeah, no, I don't think that the interstate information is ever really going to be a search. It's just there, how do you when you write this opinion, again, we're talking, look, I don't know. We're talking, I mean, time flies when you're having fun, right? I mean, how long is it going to take for Anthony's dystopian view of the world, to come true, right? I mean, right now it can come true today if we actually put the investment in there. But let's just 20 years, right? And everything's like exponential, right? 20 years is a long time for technology. But let's just say 20 years, you have this dystopian view, 50 years. Let's just make it even more realistic. 50 years, and you have this mesh system. I still don't think that seeing a person traveling across the country and then, or, doing this generic kind of, like, I just don't think that's where we're at. I think it has to be very detailed, and it has to be like at that, look, it has to be like at that GPS level, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not just, not just going across the country, not just going to New York for a day and then driving all the way back to Chicago, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And doing that three times over the last 3 months or month. You would have to be way more definite and detailed than that.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of LPRs. I think that they're great. Kind of takes a lot of the guessing game out of it. For, like before LPRs, you had to use the human behavior aspect while you're having a conversation to determine, like, are they trying to be deceptive or are they telling the truth? Now you kind of already have a factual timeline, and if they are being deceptive, it helps you build that reasonable suspicion so much faster and so much easier than, I don't know, say 10 years ago or whatever.
I love it. I absolutely. I mean, now I would wonder, do you need reasonable suspicion to even access that LPR data? Is that adding? Well, go ahead.
I'll say, like,
if
as
it's
of
adding
now,
time.
Yeah. Oh, I guess. Yeah. I guess it depends
no,
on what you
do. If it
had
times, right? If it had times, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. Yeah. I guess if you do it prior to the stop or.
Right.
Then I think you're good. I think if you're accessing that database during traffic enforcement, which is the goal, the traffic stop, then you might have to answer the why you did that. But
I agree. I think that, I don't know if I can answer that, because that's exactly what I'm looking for. Like, if you are going to add time, like we know, I just answered, right? We know that running criminal history, even if it adds time, is part of the stop. It can be, if you want it to be part of the stop. Yeah. But LPRs are not.
I agree.
However, can we transition to that, though?
Yeah, for
there
sure.
There are ways for people like you to actually, there's ways to pursue your hunches, because that's what they are, right? I mean, we're not talking about racial profiling. We're not talking about that. That's illegal, immoral, unethical, unconstitutional, right?
Yep.
We're talking about criminal profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are ways to pursue your criminal hunches without unlawfully extending a traffic stop. How do you teach that?
For me, it's always just the conversation. And then once I, I don't use, so simultaneously engaging in conversation. When I conduct my traffic stops, I'm either with them or they're with me. However you want to do it, whatever's more comfortable to you. For me, sometimes I'm standing outside my car. If it's super cold, I have them give them the opportunity to sit in my front seat, and I'm doing my traffic stop that way. And I'm not comparing their stories to any other person. I can't say, like, oh, when people lie, they do this. I compare them, their factual information that they provide to me, with the answers that they respond with when it comes to travel, purpose, relationship to the vehicle or occupancy or anything along those lines. So what I'll do is I don't ask things in chronological order. Oftentimes I'm mixing, your travel plans, your relationship with factual information, what your last name is, how old you are, what's your birthday, what's your address. So now I can compare, like, every time they've answered these factual things that I know are the truth based on their license that they provided, is this way consistently. And then when I ask about travel, they're doing this, that, whatever they're doing that's, you know, being deceptive. Well, why would you answer the truth this way, which I know is the truth, and you're answering something along the lines when it comes to travel or you know, purpose or those types of things, and you're giving me different answers or different mannerisms or things along those lines.
I think, like, to me, the way that I would just say that is that you're comparing them to themselves.
Yeah.
Right. You're comparing them to them. What, you know, that's actually pretty good. That's, I like that actually. I think that's a good way of looking at it, because people maybe do have weird lives. Maybe they do, you know, maybe it is possible that somebody travels one direction, you know, a one-way rental car, but they do fly back. They might have their reasons. You're right. Maybe they did want to, they, you know, before they leave the earth, they want to actually see the United States, but they don't need to see it twice, you know, across the United States. So that's actually good. You know, obviously, like, your class, you're getting into, like, the methods of interdiction, right? How, you know, the common things that you see and comparing their stories and so forth. You know, at Blue to Gold, we don't really teach that because we teach just the case law, right? And so what we teach is five ways. And you tell me if you like this or don't like it. Give me your feedback, okay? We teach in our advanced traffic stops class, we teach five ways to pursue your hunches without violating the Constitution. And for those people who are watching, it's the Rodriguez case, right? That's the big one, right?
Yep.
And it's that whole Rodriguez stands for the proposition that you cannot extend a traffic stop beyond its stated mission, which is why you stop them, to pursue hunches. Now, the first way that we teach it, and you tell me what you like, is consent. Now, do you believe that an officer can ask for consent? I'm not saying they will or should or whatever, but just, do they have the authority, the right, I guess, right, to ask for consent without reasonable suspicion during a traffic stop?
In Indiana, yes. I know there's some states that I
sure.
think New
Under
Jersey's
the Fourth
one.
Amendment.
Yeah, I think in New Jersey, one is that you have to have reasonable suspicion before you ask consent.
New York, New Jersey, New Mexico,
okay.
You know, Alaska, Hawaii, you know, Montana. There's some weird states out there. But you do believe that, right?
Yep.
Okay, so do I. Now, the other thing is that it's like, but however, though, I do caution officers that if they're asking for consent without reasonable suspicion, you know, that's kind of, I mean, you are playing with fire a little bit, you know. You agree, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's an effective way if you're just going to arbitrarily stop cars and then ask them to search. It just, I think if anything, you're doing the community a disservice, and you're going to build up a lot of frustration as a cop if you're out there trying to be proactive because you're not basing it on anything. It's just, oh, I stopped a car, I'm going to ask them to search just because I have the ability
right.
to.
Because I'm bored?
Yeah, it doesn't.
You got
make
nothing
a lot of
better
sense.
To do? There's no real criminals out there? I mean, look, the reality is this. If I got stopped, and I'm talking about me here, you know, I'm gainfully employed, I don't do drugs, I have no criminal history, you know, and my travel, you know, I'm just, everything makes sense about me, you know. Maybe I do ride dirty, though. I just wanted to let you know. And I know some troopers like, Anthony, if I caught you, you'll go to prison. Kenny, I don't have a front license plate, and I have illegal tints. And the thing is, I don't care. I'll go to prison, Kenny. I don't care, okay? I love having a legal tint, and I love not having a front license plate because it makes my car look dumb. All right. So so I get stopped for this, okay? And the cop says, hey, can I search your car? It would, and I love law enforcement to death, right? But I'd be like, why are you asking me to search my car? That's kind of insulting in a sense, right?
Yep.
I mean, let me search your house then, officer. I mean, you know, so look, they can ask it, but they should have a reason. I think we agree. Now, the one thing that they can do, which I do teach, is not only ask for consent to search, but maybe ask for consent to ask unrelated questions. Like, let's say you're by yourself and you're like, something is odd about this, right? Something is off. I don't have reasonable suspicion, and I don't want to be accused of extended traffic stop for unlawful, but I can ask for consent. Hey, sir, can I ask you something that's off topic? Something that's not related to the stop? And then you kind of go from there. So far, so
I like
good.
That. Yeah, I
okay,
like
good.
That.
Okay, good. And we actually, there was a case out of Illinois that kind of probably resolved an issue. The cop, it was a tweaker, right? That had like some brand new like lawn equipment in his mower, weed whacker. He had this brand new, and you know, the cop was like thinking it's probably stolen, right? And, you know, it's a hunch, right? You can't just stereotype people. Like if they suffer from drug addiction, then they also are, they can never own anything new, right? But the officer, instead, he peppered him with a bunch of questions about the stuff, right? And the court threw it out. But he could have been like, hey, man, I got to tell you, can I ask you some questions about the lawnmower you have there? Why'd you pick that model? What'd you pay for it? You know, stuff like that. The next thing we teach is downtime. So downtime is what? Like you're waiting for dispatch, right? You're waiting for their, you know, you're waiting for their warrant check. That's a good one. That's a good one. But the only problem I have with it is that sometimes the court may ask you, well, you are waiting for their criminal history. You're waiting for whatever, their wants. Why couldn't you start doing this? You know, why couldn't you start scratching that ticket? Do you think that's probably, yeah, I think the cop should have an answer.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm writing my warning as those checks and stuff are taking place.
Right, exactly.
I think a reasonable person could multitask enough and do that. And you could still communicate.
That's the next one. Yeah. Okay. No, I'm not trying to cut you off. I'm just saying that's what most interdiction officers do, right? But it's like some officers would be like, there are some cases out there where it talks about while the officer is waiting for dispatch to return, they ask unrelated questions. However, if I was a defense attorney, I'd be like, hey, just tell me why do you have to wait? Like, why can't you start? I mean, it's a traffic ticket. Now, if the officer says that plays a role in my discretion, if he's wanted, I'm not gonna write him a ticket. I'm gonna put that in the booking charges. If he has no history, I might just give him a warning for the speed, whatever. I'm just saying cops should be prepared to answer that. The next one is the multitasking. I would tell you, like I tell my guys, if you watch interdiction videos, that's probably very common, right? The officer is doing their business while they're having a consensual conversation with the person.
Yeah, no, right? You have to, because if you're not multitasking by having them with you or you with them, in the grand scheme of things, if you do, I guess, do a conventional traffic stop, you're with them maybe 30 seconds each time, maybe a minute at most. So you have 2 minutes. If you have them with you the entire traffic stop, you have them 7 to 10 minutes.
And right, they're in the passenger seat.
Yeah, yep.
Have you ever had anybody not want to go in the passenger seat?
I have. It's not as common, but I've had a few, and basically then we'll just stand outside the passenger seat of my car.
Sure.
I'll just grab my warning book and my computer. I can kind of flip around, run things that way, and I have them stand kind of in front of my door. Like, so I open my passenger door, and they're kind of like a...
Okay, so you're at the passenger side.
Of my car, yes.
Exactly. Actually, I'm glad you told me this, because I have... in my head kind of come up with those scenarios, like, cause it's hard for a lot of officers. They don't have, you know, they're not going to write a paper ticket when that's not, they have it as a backup, you know, plan, but they want to kind of keep consistent. So they're going to type an MDT. So just go on the passenger side and just have that guy, you know, have some reactionary gap, whatever, but
yep.
You know, but there's risk in everything, right? I mean, you know, Absolutely. It is what it is, right? I mean, there are plenty of cops that's like, no way is anybody ever getting into my passenger seat. Well, then you probably wouldn't be an ideal candidate for the next interdiction spot. It is what it is. I mean, you kind of have to roll with the punches here. So
I was completely apprehensive to going into working the highway. It took me about 2 years before I started and I tell everyone, just train. Like if you train that way, like train like DTs with someone in your front seat, train with like your weapon and your taser and all these other things. Like if you train that way, when it comes down to application, you feel so much more comfortable. Cause it took me a while to feel comfortable. Cause I came from a city, went to the highway and I saw these guys doing it. I'm like, man, that's crazy to me. But once I trained, I was like, okay, it makes sense. I get it now.
I was talking to a trooper that was doing interdiction. I said, man, don't you ever get worried, you know, that the guy's going to pull out a gun? He says, not really. He says, if I see him doing something hanky, I'm just going to leave. I said, what do you mean? He says, I'm going to jump out of that car and start, like, you know, like basically put some distance between them, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know, obviously, you know, you're going to know where their hands are at. If their hands start going, you know, furtive movements and so forth, yeah, maybe just leave, you know, and if he pulls out a gun, you're going to, you know, pepper your own car, I guess. So we have, I teach consent. We talked about the problems there. We talked about downtime. It's good, but not great. We talked about multitasking. That is very good, but you got to be on your A game there, right? Because you got to make sure that momentum of the traffic stop is still moving forward. The next thing I teach, and it's my favorite, is the backup officer. So it's not an option for a lot of interdiction guys, though.
Correct.
But it is the ideal one, right? Where if you can have one doing the traffic stop and another one talking, and because I like to tell people, hey, Rodriguez is all about time, not topic.
Yep.
You can ask whatever you want as long as you're not extending and adding time to that traffic stop. You know?
Exactly.
That's good. And then I say the last one is an option, and I call it the Trooper two-step. You, of course, know what the Trooper two-step is, right? And the Kansas two-step, you know, they had a little issue. But it's that where you end the traffic stop and engage in a consensual encounter. And, you know, that has its advantages too. You got to be careful. They have to, it's called the clean break rule. They have to feel like, hey, you know, they have to feel, you know, pretty much like free to leave, all the paperwork and stuff back. Do you guys ever do those ones?
We've had issues in our state where
yes,
and maybe it's just the way that we were doing it, and then the clarification. But the prosecutors aren't a big fan of it, so we kind of in it. But we are very, like, you know, very pro police state in general. So they feel like if you have reasonable suspicion during that stop, that the two step thing is unnecessary, I guess.
Thank you.
Because
thank you for saying that.
Because you already have reasonable suspicion, and the analogy they do. I know there's some other caveats to it, but if you believe someone is drinking and driving, are you going to say, hey, you're free to go? And then as they kind of break away, hey, no, can you now come back and submit? So like, they're like, if you have reasonable suspicion of a crime, you're not letting them go. Just go into, can you search, or whatever you're going to do, or whatever your next steps are. So that's kind of the model that we follow now.
Now, I don't know. Have you found that a lot of prosecutors, well, look, you actually said the opposite, right? I have found that a lot of prosecutors in that, when the lot, a lot is a relative, meaning it's not the majority, but it's more than it should, is that they're saying, even if they do if the cops have reasonable suspicion, do the Trooper two-step, right? Do the clean break, make them feel free to leave, ask for consent, and if they say no, re-detain them for the canine. And yeah, I don't see, like it.
I feel like I agree. I'm not a fan of it either. If you have a reasonable suspicion, you have a reasonable suspicion. I feel like the courts could then, I'm just being devil's advocate here. The courts could then, like, well, did you really believe you had reasonable suspicion if you let him go? And then now it's just, again, on the officer to say, you know, yes, this is what, you know, we do as common practice or whatever. And then I would assume that the prosecutor at that point would kind of step up and be like, no, we've been advocating for this way, or whatever they're going to say. I would hope anyways.
No, and so I don't like it because it to me it just screams lack of credibility. Like, why would you let a guilty guy, a guy that you think is involved in criminal, especially like drug trafficking, and so why would you let that guy go, ask for consent, and then it's like, to me it's like, well, you didn't get what you wanted, now you're going to make it all up, right? You know the law is pretty clear here. I mean, Terry versus Ohio says that you can take a reasonable amount of time while you diligently pursue in a means of investigation that will confirm or dispel your suspicions. And the guy's not free to leave. I mean, Terry wasn't free to leave. So I don't like it. They're in their defense. They say, well, if they're free to leave and you get consent, we have no coercion issues. Well, fine. But we also know from Watson, which is a Supreme Court case from 1976, that people even under arrest can give consent to search if we're not being coercive, right? No, we're not being overly coercive. We're not threatening them. We're not putting hands on our gun. We're not, you know, and it's like, so it's just like, it is what it is. So I completely agree. I just don't teach it. It is an option. Now what I teach is, if you have nothing, you don't have reasonable suspicion, you can't put your finger on it, then do the Trooper two-step, ask for consent. Cause you really shouldn't be asking for consent without reasonable suspicion during a traffic stop. In my view, we talked about that. Yep. Let them go. Do the Trooper two-step. If they say no, have a good day.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If they're not willing to freely engage you, you kind of don't have anything at that point. So
no, you don't. You don't have anything, but no harm, no foul. I mean, again, now one thing, look, I would actually like to pick your brain on this, because we talked about it briefly about reasonable suspicion. It's a low standard and so forth. But the way I look at it, and you tell me if you see a flaw in this, okay? Again, I don't have your experience, never have, never will, because I don't have a gift, quite frankly, for drugs. And maybe that's a wrong attitude. Maybe you'll correct me on that. But I was just never good at it, Kenny. I'm just telling, like, when I was on the street, I was a gram guy, you know? I don't think I was not going to find kilos, because some of the interdiction guys that I've met, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of great interdiction people out there. I mean, they're all over the place. They just have a knack, man. They have a gift. And I think they're very, you know, they're very astute of human behavior and so forth. Okay. You know, Craig Meyer, right? Craig Meyer, yeah. He's not in interdiction, but he is criminal interdiction. You know, he's more or less looking for the guns and so forth, but he's not out there getting kilos necessarily. But Craig Meyer has a gift, you know? And so what I teach my cops is, hey, you know, when it comes to reasonable suspicion, just think of you don't create reasonable suspicion, right? You find it. It's either there or it's not. But usually if it's there, it is there. And you have to know enough and like learn and go to these classes and learn from other people who have done it to know like what you are looking for. Cause it probably is there.
Yeah.
Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that I think you have the ability to communicate pretty well with everyone. And you don't come off as this authoritative figure. And I think that
right.
If you would have maybe had the experiences or people around
or
you
mentorship.
That
with, maybe yeah, mentorship.
Mentorship that you yep. might have been good at interdiction. But I think that in order to be good at interdiction, you have to have someone that will mentor you. You have to have someone that is going to show you how things are done systematically. I think that a lot of interdiction guys are very like systematic. I mean, every traffic stop is different, but you know, there's a way that, you know, most interdiction guys go about it. Maybe they get asked specific questions at specific times, how they ask it. I try to be very unassuming, you know, just ask things like, okay, you're traveling across country in someone else's car. And I'm like, oh, a couple of days off work. I don't ask like, oh, you don't have a job. Cause you know, that's accusatory. Ask it in an unassuming way.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, a few days off work. Yeah. I'm off today. I'm like, cool. Okay. What kind of work do you do? You know, like in very unassuming ways. And I think as you age in your career in law enforcement, you understand how to communicate a little bit better. I think the academy kind of makes you very robotic, if that makes sense. And you come out,
as time
evolves, I think that the communication comes back and it comes down to just being open-minded, sitting back and listening. And when I let people just talk to me, like, and I don't say a lot. I just kind of sit back and let them feed me a bunch of stuff, and then they'll say stuff that's incriminating that they're not realizing it. And then as I'm, you know, doing my traffic enforcement, I just go have that conversation. Like, you said you were doing this. Like, that's interesting because you shouldn't be on this road, or, you know, but I don't ask it in that very, you know, aggressive manner. I'll be like, why are you on this road if you're coming from there and you're going to there? Like, you know, just unassuming ways.
Yep.
And then you put them on the spot. They've already given you a bunch of free information at that point. No matter what anyone goes out there and teaches you, you have to also be a practitioner and you have to be motivated to do it. So it's a combination, and it's a very unique profession because you have to be motivated enough when the time arises, yet patient enough for the right car to come by. It's different.
Yeah, it is different. I do like that because I just teach, like, some of the greatest cops I've ever met are inquisitive people. They're not accusatory, but they're not dumb. They know something's going on, but they don't necessarily show their hand, or they get people to, you know, dig their own grave, right? To dig their own conviction. And I mean, even like a lot of my gang officers, right? Some of the best gang officers would probably make some of the best interdiction officers because they know how to talk to people.
Yep.
You know, especially gang guys, which are, you know, a lot of these guys have been to prison, but they still, they'll give this cop consent, but they won't give consent to this guy because it's all about how to talk to people.
Yep. And within comes interdiction, you need to be able to talk to like a gang guy and also like a guy that maybe is worth a couple $1 million. So you just have to kind of be almost like a chameleon and mold who you are, given whatever the circumstances you're in at that moment and who you're dealing with.
One of the last things I want to talk about, and, you know, I don't know if you have any other issues, and I think we should do these again.
Yeah,
I think people are going to find these interesting. But one thing I was, and I appreciate the compliment, by the way, about, you know, I would make a good interdiction officer. I'm probably rethinking my career now. I might tell Blue to Gold to go pound sands because I want to go get some kilos. You know, just be kind of cool, right? There's a rush there, you know,
oh, like
100%. You said, even like there's the adrenaline. When I was at a conference, and there was this Texas trooper there, and he, you know, he's an interdiction officer, forget his name. And he's a very funny guy, by the way. So, and that's also like, that's a very trademark thing for Texans, right? They're some of the funniest people. But he was talking in his own way, and he's like, let me show you like the last, I don't know, like the last 10 or 15 people who I've caught interdicting, right? And I got to tell you, I mean, I had my stereotypes in my head. I said to myself, I know what these people are going to look like. You know, it's going to look like they're on the movie Sicario, you know? Or the mule, right, with Clint Eastwood. They're going to look like that. And so he puts up the first picture, an old lady. The next picture, a young college kid. And he goes on like this. And, you know, and some kind of fell into the whatever you want to think about what a drug traveler looks like at the southern border, right? But a lot of people, the point was this, and he made it very strongly because I don't think he could have done any better. The point is, you know, you need to open up your eyes. These drug traffickers are from all walks of life. And and the reason I thought about it, because you talk about the guy that's a millionaire, right? Yeah, I mean, millionaires have cash problems too. Shit, they probably have more cash problems than sometimes some poor people, right? So I think that's a good lesson. Would you agree? I mean, you probably arrested some of the wildest people that you have. If you weren't really thinking about it, you would have just waved and, you know, waving goodbye, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, the oldest one was 76. The youngest was 17. Doctors, lawyers to, unemployed. The high school kid was a 17-year-old. All involved in the game. So, and it's any race, any religion, anything. Greed does funny things to people.
It does. Yep, absolutely. So I don't have any more questions. I know, you know, we talked about some of the pressing issues that I thought were relevant for this. And I hope we can do this again. Anything else that you want to talk about?
What about one thing? What about drone technology and case law? I know some people are using drones to search semis once they have probable cause instead of climbing the load. I thought it was cool. I mean, it's, you know, using technology to, you know, every advantage you can.
That's right. So we are looking for, you know, looking forward to it, but you know, we need a good, we need a drone case from the U.S. Supreme Court because I teach a drone class and the $1 million question is, at least not for the semis, but just the kind of like, when do drones become searches under the Fourth Amendment? Right. Remember, there's privacy and there's trespass. Well, they're not trespassing. Well, in the semi truck they are, but when it's not privacy, like when does a drone, you know, violate or intrude on a person's reasonable expectation of privacy? So that's a whole conversation for another day. That's probably not really, you know, the people watching this are like, okay, well, I'm not using a drone to look in people's windows at a house. I'm using a drone for cars.
Right.
First of all, the baseline is that a drone looking at a car is almost never going to be a search, right? So for those officers out there, they're like, hey, I want to deploy a drone to look at a car that's in a parking lot, or I want to see if I can see a hand-to-hand transaction. I want to see if they can, you know, any other kind of things, if they're messing with a trap or something like that. And I want that drone 400 feet in the air, which is going to probably be pretty invisible. And I want to look at them. Well, clearly we can do that. At least clearly in my world, because there's no trespass and there's no expectation of privacy on what you're doing out in a public space. This is not like Carpenter and all these things that we're kind of, you know, pontificating on. This is totally different. Now, as we go into the vehicle, clearly deploying a drone to hover inside of a trailer, that is a trespass. And it's also an expectation of privacy issue, right? Because, you know, you're seeing things that are not visible to the public eye. There's an expectation of privacy there. Now you said you did it with, you would do it with, or the people are doing it with PC. Well, PC is your exception because yeah, you have a search, but you have a recognized exception, which is the motor vehicle exception. I guess something more interesting to me legally would be, well, consent. I think that's one issue, right? So one thing is that the consent, a valid consent has a scope. All consent searches have three things: voluntary, authority, and scope. So voluntary, didn't coerce it. Authority, am I asking the right guy to search, right? You don't ask the babysitter to search the house, right? Yeah. You don't ask the valet parker to search the car because it's not their car. And then the scope. This is a scope issue, right? So the scope is defined by, to tell you circumstances, but usually by words used, you know, and context. So if you asked me to search my car, and you said for drugs, and I said yes, and then the canine unit shows up 5 minutes later and you stop searching my car and now deploy that canine around my car, right? Or especially, let's say you even something more like you deploy the canine into the back of my tractor trailer. The question for the court is, did he consent to that? And the answer is probably not. Because in that case, the canine was not on scene. And it was not a reasonable person would not contemplate that you would, we can debate it, right? But there's, we can debate it. But there's a case out of Pennsylvania that kind of talks about this, that they just suppress it because it wasn't contemplated. Now, if it says canine handler, or the dog is on scene, we know the dog is on scene, and then we ask for consent to search for drugs, the canine is in play.
Gotcha.
Well, that concept, that issue is with the drone. So if you asked me, can I search your car for drugs or my semi truck? And a reasonable person, the court's gonna have to figure this out whether or not it exists or not, but a reasonable person would not believe that the cops would deploy a drone. But then again, the counter argument is that, but Anthony, the drone is not seeing anything that it couldn't see with the naked eye. So yeah. Maybe it comes in. But let's say go ahead.
That's what I was gonna say. Like, I think their reason is like, instead of crawling the load, possibly damaging products, like now
that's
I
right.
They might be thanking you. Yeah, I guess that would be my counter argument to it. Like you're saying, like I don't know. That would be interesting to see what the courts say.
I don't think that's gonna win it right there. I think the dog is fundamentally a little bit different. A sniff, and you're deploying the dog. The dog does have some capabilities that the drone, the drone's plain view, right?
Yep.
But also remember though, if we have PC, then we're good. We don't need this. We can do whatever it takes to search that vehicle. But let's say that the drone has a technology that it can actually see through metal, right? It's like what the Border Patrol has for seeing body loads, right?
Yep.
And that drone has that capacity, right? And as it's hovering inside of the 18-wheeler, let's say we don't have probable cause. If we have probable cause, we don't have these issues. But we have consent. And the drone is flying and it can actually see voids. I think that's a problem.
Okay.
I think
I would agree there too.
Yeah. And unless you ask the person, hey, can I search your car for drugs? Cool. Also have a drone. Makes things kind of easy. I'm gonna use the drone too if you're cool with that. And the guy says, yeah, I'm cool with that. Then we're good. You don't have to tell them exactly what the drone's gonna see. I like to say that the person should, a reasonable person, if they sat down and contemplated what you're gonna do, they would have been like, yeah, I probably would have imagined they would have done that. That's why the canine is an issue unless it's on scene.
Awesome. I like it.
All right. Well, there you go. Anything else?
That's it. That's all I have.
Well, man, this is a great conversation. I appreciate your time and I hope the audience got something out of it. I think they will. So for those who are following Blue to Gold, I appreciate you guys. And for those who are following your, how can they reach you, by the way? How can my audience reach you and see what you're doing out there?
Instagram's the easiest. You can follow me personally. It's @redninja_111. Briefly, we'll talk about a conference we're doing. It's for $99, 4 days,
yes.
April 21st to April 25th in Myrtle Beach. Those dates might be a little off, but it's in April 20th to 21st, somewhere around there is the start date. There's like 12 different companies that came together. Everyone's donating their time, just trying to give, something back to law enforcement. So those are the two things that we have going on that, if someone's interested, you can follow me at Red Ninja on Instagram. And then look us up at the Justice Academy training online.
Nice. And for those who are following on your channel, bluetogold.com, if you look at the top, we have our Instagram, our YouTube and so forth, Facebook. And so I'm just curious who the other 110 Red Ninjas are before you on Facebook.
Well, so the 111 is my badge number.
Oh, you want to turn my joke into something serious? Okay. You deflated that joke. All right, guys. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And stay safe, everyone, and keep up doing the good work. Any final parting words?
No, I appreciate you guys' time. Thank you.